Let's continue today with some of these undated psalms, many of which are not specifically from David, but which came about ultimately because of David's desire that psalms be composed and performed in the temple that he had designed and passed on to King Solomon. So let's begin today in Psalm number 43, which is clearly related to Psalm 42 because it has some of the same language at the tail end of it. Vindicate me, O God, and defend my cause against ungodly people from the deceitful and unjust man. Deliver me, for you are the God in whom I take refuge. Why have you rejected me? Why do I go about mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? So you got this emotional content here where the person feels like God's not stepping in. God's not taking care of things instantly. And so he feels that things are going badly and he wants God to intervene. Verse number 3, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill, to your dwelling. And then I will go to the altar of God, to God, my exceeding joy, and I will praise you with the lyre, O God, my God. So the psalmist, even though they're frustrated by the fact that things are not turning the way they think they ought to, nor as quickly as they ought to, they're still committed to worshiping God, getting in that procession of worship that goes to either the tabernacle or maybe to the place where the Ark of the Covenant is located at David's palace, or ultimately into the new temple being built by Solomon. Wants to go to the altar and express their thanksgiving to God and sing praises and play the musical instrument that they're gifted with. And so that's where we ought to be as well. No matter what our circumstances, we ought to be ready to go and worship with others over the God that we know can be trusted, even though sometimes we have to remind ourselves of that, which is how the psalm ends. And this is something in common with the previous psalm. Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you in turmoil within me? See, talking to ourselves, telling ourselves, what's the issue here? What's the problem? Come on. Verse 6 continues, hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. So we have to remind ourselves from time to time, circumstances don't dictate how we live out our lives of relationship with God. Our relationship with God does that. And so we put our hope in God. We keep our hope in Jesus Christ. He's our salvation. He is who is salvation. And so keep our focus where it needs to be. Well, Psalm number 44 next. Psalm number 44 has a superscription that says it's to the choir master. It's a maskil, which is some sort of psalm, of the sons of Korah, which seems to be a music-producing group or element within Israeli life. And it may be that David is the ultimate organizer of the sons of Korah. But here's the psalm that they offer. It says, O God, we have heard with our ears, our fathers have told us, what deeds you performed in their days, in the days of old. You with your own hand drove out the nations, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples, but them, that is the Israelis, you set free. For not by their own sword did they win the land, nor did their own arm save them, but your right hand and your arm and the light of your face, for you delighted in them. So this psalm starts with a historical confession that we've heard the stories of old. We've heard the stories of miraculous coming into the promised land and how you, God, were the one that made the difference for our ancestors. Verse number 4, you are my king, O God, ordain salvation for Jacob. Through you we push down our foes. Through your name we tread down those who rise up against us. For not in my bow do I trust, nor can my sword save us, but you have saved us from our foes and have put to shame those who hate us. In God we have boasted continually, and we will give thanks to your name forever. Selah. And Selah seems to be some sort of notation to bring the music up here or have this great big interlude. But the content here is a declaration of trust and faith. The idea that we know personally that we don't save ourselves. It's you that does all the good things. You did it in the past, and we know you can do it again. Now, this is interesting because the next thing that they bring out is problems. Problems that are going on right now. Even though they've expressed verbally, in song, their trust in God, they are confused and uncertain as to their current situation. Something bad is going on, and they don't understand where it's coming from. So this is how they express themselves. Verse 9, "But you have rejected us and disgraced us and have not gone out with our armies. You've made us turn back from the foe, and those who hate us have gotten spoil. You made us like sheep for slaughter and have scattered us amongst the nations. You've sold your people for a trifle," that is, for a little bit of money, "demanding no high price for them. You have made us the taunt of our neighbors, the derision and scorn of those around us. You've made us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. All day long my disgrace is before me, and shame has covered my face at the sound of the taunter and reviler, at the sight of the enemy and the avenger." So things are going badly. Things are horrible. But the psalmists here do not understand why that's the case. Verse 17, "All this has come upon us, though we've not forgotten you, and we've not been false to your covenant. Our heart is not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your ways. Yet you've broken us in the place of jackals and covered us with the shadow of death. If we've forgotten the name of our God or spread out our hands to a foreign God, would not God discover this? For he knows the secrets of the heart, and yet for your sake we are killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered." Now it's possible that this song may come much later in Israel's history. Can't be sure about that. But it's possible, maybe during a time leading up to or during the Assyrian exile or the Babylonian exile. And that what's being expressed here is bad things are happening to us and we don't feel we've done anything to deserve it. Why are you not intervening? The last line that we just read, verse 22, you will find that quoted in the New Testament, in Romans chapter 8, where Paul is going over the idea that even in the midst of bad things happening, we know that God is able to work together all things together for the good of those who love him and who are called according to his purposes. Trouble was coming upon the Christians of that time period, and Saul wanted them to understand that, hey, sometimes this is just what happens to God's people. Sometimes we just get butchered because of the attitudes, the bad attitudes of other people. But the psalmists here, when they see a situation like that happening, they want to know, where is God? Why is he not jumping in and taking care of this thing? And so that's how the psalm ends. This is an emotional psalm, and I've told you that we sometimes just have to go with the feeling that's involved here. Verse 23, "Awake! Why are you sleeping, O he who is? Rouse yourself! Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust, our belly clings to the ground. Rise up! Come to our help! Redeem us for the sake of your steadfast love." So this psalm is kind of a downer. It closes even on this idea of, where's God? Come on, God, get in here and do something. But to be quite honest, sometimes that's how we feel. Sometimes we feel like God is not jumping in like we want him to. And as is so often clear in these Psalms, we need to just hang in there, do the right thing, and be patient and let God take care of things on his time scale. Because as Peter reminds us in the New Testament, our time scale is nothing like God's. I mean, for him, 1,000 years is no more than a day. It doesn't even feel like an hour passing in the middle of the night to him, because God is outside of time. So he takes care of things on the much larger scale of time. Be patient and wait. Psalm number 45, to the choir master, according to lilies, so that's either a tune or maybe an instrument, a maskil, which is a style of song apparently, of the sons of Korah. So here we've got a group that seems to be committed to musical performances or musical production. And then we have this little commentary at the very end, a love song. So it's got something to do with relationship. Verse 1, my heart overflows with a pleasing theme. I address my verse to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. So whoever's writing this seems to be writing it to be dedicated to the king. Maybe Solomon, maybe someone after him. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips, and therefore God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness, lest your right hand teach you awesome deeds, let your right hand teach you awesome deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the hearts of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. So it's likely that it's not going to be about Solomon, since Solomon was a man of peace. And what's being put forward here is that the king in this poem, this song, is a man of warfare. So maybe it's addressed to David or some later descendant of David. But the next section is grabbed and used in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. So you'll find that in Hebrews chapter 1. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of righteousness. And because it's applied in the book of Hebrews, it seems that the Hebrew writer believed that it was about Jesus. Your scepter, O God, is forever and ever. That's about Jesus being the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of uprightness, because we know that God, that Jesus is the King of uprightness. You've loved righteousness and hated wickedness. You know, love is all about commitment. So Jesus is committed to righteousness. Hatred is all about non-commitment. He's not committed to doing the wicked stuff. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And that's kind of an application of Jesus being the anointed one. He is the Christos, that's the Greek. He's the Christ. He is the Mashiach, that's Hebrew, Messiah. And he has been anointed as such, making him more significant than anyone else in all of the universe. Verse 8, your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. So whoever this king of Israel is, he's dressed up really fancy and he smells really good. Verse 10, hear, O daughters, and consider and incline your ear. Forget your people in your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. since he is your Lord, bow to him. The people of Tyre will seek your favor with gifts, the richest of the people. All glorious is the princess in her chamber, with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she's led to the king, with her virgin companions following behind her. With joy and gladness they're led along as they enter the palace of the king. In place of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth, and I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations, and therefore nations will praise you forever and ever. So you can kind of see here why it's got the heading, a love song, because it seems to be a reference to some sort of marriage ceremony between a king in Israel and some princess from somewhere else, and how they become a married couple and their children end up in successive lines to the throne. But in the middle of it, as we already saw, there's a prophetic reference to Jesus, who is the ultimate King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and the lady that he takes to himself is the church, his bride. And so a very interesting application of this psalm in the New Testament. Well, let's go to number 46 next. Superscription says, to the choir master of the sons of Korah, according to the Alamot, which is either an instrument or a song, and then it says, it's a song. Verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear though the earth gives way, though the mountains be removed into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swellings. Selah. So even when there's these natural disasters happening all around us, we remember by this psalm that God is right there. God is our refuge. God is our strength. He will get us through this. Verse 4, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. He who is over the armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. And so whatever this river is that makes the city of God happy, if it's the Kidron, or maybe it's the water coming out of the Gihon spring, or possibly it is the prophetic river that will eventually be flowing from the Temple Mount, both directions, east and west. We see this in the book of Revelation, in the book of Ezekiel. Doesn't matter whether it's past, present, or future river, metaphorical or otherwise. God is there in the midst of his people, and he is taking care of business, and that's why he should be praised. Verse 8, come, behold the works of he who is, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow, shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. So God intervened at different times throughout Israeli history to give great victories. And then ultimately he will intervene at the Battle of Armageddon, Book of Revelation, and will stop the attempt to keep Jesus from coming as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So that's what the bad people, the evil people, the followers of the beast leader, they're going to try to stop Jesus from coming. But God steps in and makes sure that they don't accomplish that. Verse 10, be still and know that I am God. I'm exalted above the nations, or among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. He who is over the armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. So a good reminder that in the midst of all these issues, these difficulties that come up in life, just take a moment, pause, rest, take a breath, and be still and remember God is God, and we owe him praise and loyalty and adoration, and let him take care of the details. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, seek first the kingdom of God and all its attendant righteousness, and all these other things, you know, what we're going to wear, what we're going to eat, where we're going to live, things like that, all these other things will be added unto you. That's the promise. So trust. Psalm number 47. To the choir master, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Clap your hands, all peoples. Shout to God with loud songs of joy. So immediately we've got this big praise thing going on. The clapping of the hands in celebration. The shouting aloud with these songs of joy. Why? Verse 2. For he who is the Most High is to be feared, a great king over all the earth. He subdued peoples under us, nations under our feet. He chooses our heritage for us, the pride of Jacob, whom he loves, Selah. So it's Jewish people singing this. They're talking about how the Israeli kingdom is God's kingdom. God has gone up with a shout. The Lord, or he who is, with the sound of a trumpet, sing praises to God, sing praises to our King, sing praises, for God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with a psalm. It's possible that this psalm may have been designed or written out to be used for the movement of the Ark of the Covenant from where it's at in King David's palace up to the Temple Mount and into the Holy of Holies of the brand new Temple of Solomon. But we don't know if that's the case. But this going up sounds a little bit like the movement of the Ark up the hill. Verse 8, God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people gather as the people of the God of Abraham, for the shields of the earth belong to God. He is highly exalted. So this great assembly celebrating who God is mentioned in this song. Well, how about Psalm 48 next? A song, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Great is he who is, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of the earth. Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king, within her citadels, God has made himself known as a fortress. Now, Mount Zion today in Israel is not Mount Zion historically. Mount Zion historically was the ancient city of Jerusalem, and then it was extended northward to what we call the Temple Mount today. That's Mount Zion. And it poetically represented the place where God is. Unfortunately, the name got shifted over to the hill to the west of the original Mount Zion, so that today Mount Zion is where they'll take you to touristy places like where Herod's palace was located and the place that they call the upper room. But just be aware of that. Verse number 4, for behold, the kings assembled, they came together. As soon as they saw it, they were astounded, they were in panic, they took flight, trembling took hold of them, anguish as a woman in labor. By the east wind, you shattered the ships of Tarshish. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city, in the city of he who is over the armies, in the city of our God, which God will establish forever, Selah. So these psalmists are singing about the fact that God's giving them a great victory. It's a miraculous victory, a shocking victory. Supernatural things are happening, just like they used to in the past. Verse 9, we have thought on your steadfast love, O God, in the midst of your temple. Now that's true meditation from a biblical perspective. Meditation is not the emptying of your mind, but rather the filling of your mind with things that can be known about God, such as his steadfast love. As your name, O God, so your praise reaches to the ends of the earth. So the name of God, he who is, goes all the way to the ends of the earth. And so his praises go out there with that name. Your right hand is filled with righteousness. So righteousness is that relationship that comes from a relationship through Jesus with God the Father. So sin has been done away with, and the right thing is now in place. Let Mount Zion be glad. Let the daughters of Judah rejoice because of your judgments. So let there be celebration at the place where the Ark of the Covenant's at the place where God's throne is located, both on earth and in the heavenlies. And let the people, including the young ladies, start rejoicing about what God has done. And then it says this, walk about Zion, go around her, number her towers, consider well her ramparts, go through her citadels, that you may tell the next generation that there is a God, our God forever and ever. He will guide us forever. So these psalmists may be writing this down after the Temple Mount has been built in the time of Solomon and the palace complex is in place, and Jerusalem has doubled in size, more than doubled in size, and there's a fence around it, or a wall around it. And so the suggestion is just go wandering around and think about everything that God has done in this generation, bringing his majesty and power into such a visible form. And then remember that that God that we're worshiping in the temple is God forever and ever. He's going to give us guidance. He's going to give us protection. So a great psalm for the Jewish people in the time of Solomon. And speaking of time, we're out of it today. So we'll mark our place right here and get back into the word tomorrow, Lord willing.